So we'll start with practice, the meditation on the Buddha, as we usually do. And we'll start actually with a couple of minutes of silence, then with the meditation on the Buddha, which I think you all have the recitations to do. And then we'll go into the teaching. Okay? So again, I won't be giving a lot of detailed instruction about the visualization because I know you've been doing it in between and studying on it and are well aware of what to do. Aren't you? Okay, let's go then. Let's start letting our mind settle down. Watch the breath for a couple minutes. So in this space in front of you, visualize the Buddha, his golden body, looking at you with acceptance and compassion. He's surrounded by your direct teachers as well as the lineage teachers. All the Buddhas, deities, bodhisattvas, arhats, dakas and dakinis, and dharma protectors. So there's a huge assembly of holy beings in front of you that you can always access. And then surrounding you are all the sentient beings, your mother on your left, your father on your right, people you don't get along with, or the people you're afraid of, or those who have harmed you, are in front of you, between you and the Buddha. We and all the sentient beings around us are looking at the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha with a sense of faith in their ability to guide us and motivated by a genuine spiritual yearning. And so we see the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as our best friends, those beings that we can really trust, that will never let us down, and that always are working for our welfare. And so thinking that we're leading all the sentient beings and generating the different thoughts and feelings expressed in the recitations, then we'll begin with taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity, and the other far-reaching practices may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity, and the other far-reaching practices may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity,
teaching practices may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings.
May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes.
May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger.
Reverently,
I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and present clouds of every type of offering, actual and mentally transformed. I confess all my destructive actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. These remain until cyclic existence ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the Great Awakening.
This ground
anointed with perfume, flowers strewn Mount Meru, for land, sun, and moon, imagined as a Buddha land and offered to you. May all beings enjoy this pure land.
The objects of attachment, aversion, and ignorance, friends, enemies, and strangers, my body, wealth, and enjoyments, I offer these without any sense of loss. Please accept them with pleasure and inspire me and others to be free from the three poisonous attitudes.
Idam guru rana mandala kamhirya dayami.
And then that a replica of the Buddha comes from the Buddha in front and sits on top of your head, facing the same direction as you, and helps you when you petition the merit field. Glorious and precious Red Guru, sit upon the lotus and moon seat on my crown, guiding me with your great kindness, bestow upon me the attainments of your body, speech, and mind, the eyes through whom the vast scriptures are seen, supreme doors for the fortunate who would cross over to spiritual freedom, illuminators whose wise means vibrate with compassion, to the entire line of spiritual mentors I make request. Then as we say the mantra, light and nectar flow from the Buddha into us. We think there's a Buddha on the crowns of the heads of all the sentient beings around us. And light from those Buddhas flow into all those sentient beings. And it does two things. One is purifying negativities. And the second is bringing inspiration and bringing realizations. Taya ta omuni muni maha muni eso.
Tayata mani mani ma mani soha. Tayata mani mani ma mani soha. Tayata mani mani ma mani soha. Tayata.
Tayata,
Tayata, Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. Tayata
of the Guru Buddha on the crown of your head, and then reflect this life basis, complete with freedom and fortune, that is so difficult to attain, and once attained, so meaningful, will soon end. After its destruction, I will not cease to exist, but will be obliged to take rebirth. There are only two possible places of rebirth: a happy realm and a miserable realm. If I take rebirth in a miserable realm as a hell being, I will undergo inconceivable sufferings of heat, cold, and the like. As a hungry spirit, the sufferings of hunger, thirst, and so on. And as an animal, the sufferings of ignorance, stupidity, eating others, and being eaten. I am not capable of bearing the likes of the lower realm suffering. Now that I have attained a life basis complete with freedom and fortune that is so difficult to attain, and once attained so meaningful, may I attain the state of Buddhahood that ends all the sufferings of the lower realms. Guru Buddha, please inspire me to be able to do this. In response to your request, the Guru, you're requesting the Guru deity, five-colored light and nectar stream from all parts of the Buddha's body into you, through the crown of your head. The light and nectar absorb into your mind and body, and similarly from the Buddhas on the heads of all the sentient beings around you, light and nectar flow into them as well. Purifying all negativities, all obscurations accumulated since beginningless time. And especially purifying all illness, spirit interferences, negativities, and obscurations that interfere with attaining the state of a Buddha that ends all sufferings of the lower realms. So all those obscurations and interferences are completely purified and eliminated in you and in everybody else. Your body becomes translucent, the nature of light, and all your good qualities, lifespan, merit, and so forth, expand and increase. Think in particular that a superior realization allowing you to attain the state of Buddha that ends all sufferings of the lower realms has arisen in your mind stream and in the mind stream of others. This meditation on rebirth in the unfortunate realms can be difficult for some people. First of all, because it assumes a belief in rebirth. Yeah, we talked about that before in earlier teaching. And then even if we have some feeling of rebirth or some confidence in rebirth, then we may also have doubts about if other states of existence arise, you know, exist, or is rebirth only from human life to human life. So, and then we may wonder, you know, well, are these unfortunate states of rebirth, are they actually places, or, you know, what are they? Or are they just mental states that you can also experience as a human being? So we may have a lot of questions about this. Then we may also wonder why in the world did the Buddha teach this? Because when I think about lower rebirths, I feel scared, I feel guilty. I, you know, if I wanted to have hell realms, I would have remained a Christian. Why do I need to become a Buddhist and talk about hell realms here? So there may be all these kinds of questions that arise that are good questions, yeah? So as far as, you know, what are well, first of all, I think it's important to understand that the Buddha taught about the unfortunate rebirths, not to scare us, but out of compassion, so that we can prevent rebirth there. Yeah. It's the same way that a parent, you know, you'll tell your children, don't put your hand in the fire, because if you do, it's going to hurt. Yeah? I mean, a wise parent warns their children of potential danger. And they don't do it to make the child just terrified and panicky and frightened out of their wits. Yeah, they do it out of kindness so that the child will know, oh, this is dangerous, I'm not going to do that. So in the same way, the Buddha taught with compassion about these different realms so that we can avoid rebirth there. It's also important to remember that nobody sends us to the lower realms. There is no manager of the universe. There is no creator who gives out rewards and punishments. There is no external being that determines our rebirth. That what we're reborn as is simply a matter of cause and effect. And we are the agents that create the causes for the rebirths that we take. Nobody else does. Yeah. So it's not due to anybody else's will or somebody wanting to punish us or something like that. It's simply we created causes in our mind through what we think, what we say, and what we do. And then these ripen in the various kinds of rebirths. You know, they may be unfortunate rebirths, they may be fortunate rebirths, depending upon the causes that we create. Okay, so it's just a natural thing of cause and effect. Don't think that I'm getting punished, because you're not. There's no punisher, there's no rewarder. Okay. Then the question comes, well, are they actual realms of existence? Or can we just see them as mental states that we experience as human beings? So yes, we can see them as similar to mental states that we experience as human beings. Now, we can see that there's some people who live their whole life in great physical or mental pain. It's a reality. Some people who live their life with great fear or suspicion. Okay, so that would be analogous to a hellish rebirth. We see that some people live their life in constant dissatisfaction, running here, running there, trying to get what they want, never being successful, getting what they want, not being satisfied, or being separated from what they want, but always running around looking for something. Yeah, we see people whose lives are like that. So that could be analogous to the hungry ghost, or what's called the preta realm. And then we see some beings who are just spaced out. Yeah? They love drinking and drugging, and they just space out, you know? Space out in front of the TV, space out wherever they can. Yeah? So that, you know, that kind of spaced out mind, that's kind of like an animal realm, if you look at it. Yeah? I look into the eyes of our kitties sometimes, yeah? And it's like there's a living being there, but you can see they can't kind of think clearly, you know? They're wanting to, but can't. The mind is very obscured. So we can see, okay, there's states analogous like to this that exist in the human realm. Okay? But there's also actual realms of existence. Yeah? A realm is actually the body and mind that people take. So there are, you know, bodies, hellish bodies and minds that people take, or preta bodies and minds, or animal bodies and minds. We can see the animals. Yeah, we can see them around us. That realm's visible. The other realms we can't see unless we have some kind of clairvoyant power. Although every so often people send me photos with pictures of hungry ghosts. You know, they took a photo and there's a hungry ghost in the picture. Quite interesting. But then you say, well, how can somebody like me, who's a human being with human intelligence, have a body and mind that's so totally different, like one in the hell realm or hungry ghost realm or animal realm? Okay, how is that possible? Because, I mean, I'm so real right now. How could I have a body and mind that are so incredibly different from what I am now? Well, in terms of the body, yeah, we used to have a body this big. Yeah? Yeah, well, we used to be a zygote that was this big. Can you imagine that? That's kind of remarkable, isn't it? We used to have a mind of a zygote. What was that mind like? Yeah? But we know that, don't we? Yeah? We weren't kind of born without going through gestation in our mother's womb. Yeah? And we sure looked a whole lot different there than we do now, don't we? And our mind was a lot different then, too. Yeah. And what goes through your mind when you're a zygote? Or even when you're born, you know? Like your parents show you baby pictures? Yeah. What was going through your mind when you were that little? You know how they take pictures when you're just a few days old or whatever? What was your mind like then? It certainly didn't have the language that we have now. It certainly didn't have the knowledge that we have now. It didn't have the conceptual ability that we have now. You know, as day-old infants, we had no understanding whatsoever of the world around us. Everything was tremendously confusing. Yeah, because all of a sudden you're born and where am I? Yeah? No, there was no idea of, oh, this is my mother, this is my father, somebody's going to take care of me. Nothing, you know? The mind completely zoned out. So that's hard to imagine, isn't it? But we know that was the reality of who we were, however many years ago that we were a tiny infant. Yeah. So then why couldn't our mind be also similar to, you know, the mind of a being in another realm? And even in our human life, there's some people whose actions are so harmful, disgusting, I don't know what word to use, but we'll say, oh, they act worse than an animal. You ever heard people say that about another human being? That person acts worse than an animal. So if you look at the actions that person is doing that are worse than an animal, can you imagine that a mind that is acting worse than an animal could be born with an animal's body? That a mind that is like that takes a body that corresponds to what's going on in the mind. Or a person whose thoughts are so driven towards harming others. Yeah, towards fear and suspicion and revenge. You know, could that kind of person whose mind is so stuck in that way take a body that matched that state of mind and be born in the hellish realms? Or when we see people who are just constantly running around with dissatisfaction, you know, they marry one person, get divorced, marry another one, get divorced, marry another one, get divorced, go from this job to that job to the other job, always buying something, trying to get more, trying to get better, running here, running there, never satisfied. Could a person whose life is engaged in those kind of actions, you know, take a body in a future life that would match that those mental states, the body of a preta? Yeah? Chasing here, chasing there, always looking for something. Okay? So if you think about it in this way, you know, you may begin to say, oh, well, maybe it is possible for beings who have human bodies and minds now to take a body and mind of a being in another realm, depending upon their actions and depending upon their way of thinking. And then, you know, if you think, well, what would happen if I did that? Yeah. If you go to a time in your life, let's say, when you were exceptionally dissatisfied and greedy and just running around, I want, I've got to get, I have to have, and this mind just like this all the time. Yeah. And then you take that and say, okay, that mind then gets reborn as a hungry ghost that is always running around looking for food to satisfy it. Yeah. And it runs here and it runs there. And the karma is such that as soon as it finds something that looks good, it turns to pus and blood, and they find it disgusting and they can't eat it. Yeah. Or even they can eat it, it doesn't go down their throat because their throat's so thin. Or even it goes down their throat, it bursts into flames in their stomach. Yeah. Could that be like indicative of a certain kind of mental state? You know, and how would I respond if that were me? If I saw the world in that kind of way, could I bear that? I often think, because I did a lot of reading about the Cultural Revolution in China, you know, about people who were imprisoned and tortured. I'm, you know, quite interested in Chinese history. And I would ask myself, you know, if that were me, could I survive? And, you know, could, I don't know if my body could survive, but could my mind even survive? Or would I just crumble in the face of that kind of mental torture or physical torture? Yeah. And then, you know, if I were born in another realm, where there was that kind of mental or physical torture consistently, could I bear that? Do I have that kind of mental strength? Or even if I got very ill in this life with extreme pain, could I bear that? Or would I just totally freak out? So kind of asking, you know, yeah, if that happened to me, what would happen? Could I endure that? And then to think, you know, that such things happen, whether as human beings or, you know, taking another rebirth, that those things happen due to causes. They don't happen randomly, they don't happen accidentally, they happen due to causes. And that I would be the one creating the causes for those kinds of experiences. And then thinking about times in my life, let's say, where I was very, very greedy and demanding, or times in my life where I was just furious and filled with hatred and desire for revenge. Or times in my life where I was just totally spaced out. Now, let's say, oh, these kind of mental states and the physical and verbal actions that I've done motivated by them are the causes for life in these kind of realms. And do I want to experience those kind of lives? clearly the answer is no. Yeah, very obviously, I don't want to experience that. So, if I don't want to experience that, then I need to do something. And so the first thing I need to do is to find guidance about how to change my mind, how to stop creating those causes, and how to purify the causes I've already created. And so, therefore, that awareness of the danger of being born in these unfortunate states propels me towards taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Yeah, because I realize that, whoa, I've created a lot of harmful karma. Yeah. Even though I thought I was such a good person and so on top of things. And I don't even know what I've done in my previous lives, let alone what I've done in this life. So I need some help. Big time. Yeah, this is not a situation that my ego and self-centered thought can manage. Yeah, I need some wise guidance. And so turning to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay? So the purpose of the Buddha teaching, you know, the possibility of us taking these kinds of rebirths, like I said, was out of compassion so that we could prevent that from happening. Okay? And when we have that kind of awareness, it invigorates our Dharma practice. It creates a sense of urgency that I need to practice now because I don't know when I'm going to die. And the seeds for those kind of rebirths are on my mind stream, and if I die without having purified, I could be in really big trouble. Yeah? So, you know, I'm not going to have the attitude of mañana a la mañana. You know, I'll do it tomorrow morning. I'll do it later. First I'll have some fun in samsara. Then I'll practice the Dharma when I'm old and I can't enjoy sense pleasure very well. Yeah. So the mind that wants to procrastinate, the mind that's lazy, you know, an awareness of the possibility of these rebirths, you know, helps cut that mind. Yeah. And it helps invigorate our practice. Not in the sense of, I'm panicked, I'm freaked out, I could get born like that. Because like I said, the Buddha didn't need to teach us how to be panicked and freaked out. That's not the purpose of this. Okay. But it does invigorate our practice in the sense of, okay, I don't have any time to waste. And so, you know, am I really going to sleep more than I need to? Am I really going to watch that TV program, which, you know, I won't even think about next week? Am I really going to spend my time getting mad at this person? It doesn't make much sense to do that. So it helps us, you know, to refine the, you know, our priorities to, you know, what we want to spend our time doing. It's very helpful in that regard. And very helpful also for making us more aware of our actions, increasing our mindfulness and introspective awareness. You know, because maybe we're acting in a totally off-the-wall way. And then when we go, oh my goodness, you know, this kind of action is creating the cause for the kind of rebirth that I don't think I can endure, then I better stop acting this way. And if my mind is crazy and out of control, I better just calm it down. because it's not worthwhile to continue with this greedy mind or continue with this angry mind. It's only harming me. Yeah. So let's sit down and get myself calmer here. Okay? So it helps us in that way, you know, to monitor our actions and steer our actions in the way we want them to be. And this kind of meditation also helps us develop compassion for other beings who are already born in those realms. And it makes us realize, hey, there's nothing for me to be arrogant about and think that I'm so superior, because just one breath away and I could be born there together with them. So who am I to look at criminals or whoever it is that we think are horrible people and, you know, with a condescending, conceited mind, when one breath away my own negative karma could ripen and wham, I'm born in that kind of realm. Nothing for me to be proud of. Now, if anything, I need to have more compassion for people who are suffering. So it really helps us to generate compassion and humility. Okay. So let's pause here and see if people have any questions or comments so far. I'm not going to get into the descriptions, the detailed descriptions of each realm. I think, you know, the general description will suffice. Any questions or comments? Yeah.
So, before, you know, the Buddha came, everyone probably lived in like this bad karma state, you know, probably worse than it is now, maybe not, I don't know, maybe it's worse here. But, so how did these people just create the karma in their own lives to be able to hear and understand the Buddha's teachings and be there? Or mm-hmm. is that just the Buddha came and, you know, changed everyone? I don't
yeah.
know.
Well, we've all had many, so the question is, you know, how did people get to be disciples of the Buddha and create the cause for that? Most of that kind of karma would probably have been created in a previous life. And so people can do good, create good karma without having met the Buddha's teachings. That's possible. You know, other religions also teach ethical conduct, and some people have a strong inner sense of a strong moral rudder in sense, you know, inside of them, even though they haven't met the teachings. Yeah, so people can create good karma, but then. So much of our present life's results, you know, good results or even very bad results that we're experiencing, the karma for those was created in previous lives. Yeah. So there's many previous lives. There's many other universes. Don't think of just this planet, you know. I mean, even the scientists tell us planet Earth, tiny, minuscule dot in the universe. Don't think that this is all there is where there's life. Yeah?
So, I guess this is related a little bit to rebirth, yeah. The driving factor of, you know, being born in lower rebirths is destructive karma, negative actions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was thinking about the other day and tying it into the concept of like beginningless previous lives.
Yeah.
And well, then the thought came to me of, so beginningless lives, I mean, there's this vast amount of destructive, and probably positive too,
mm-hmm.
things that we've done. So then I was tying that to like purification, like, are we just like, okay, we're trying to do what we can do in this life and then just broad categories to try to cover it all, because it doesn't really seem like you'd be able to.
Okay, so when we, the question is, when we think of beginningless previous lifetimes, then we have to think of beginningless previous destructive actions. And so how do we even begin to purify all of those? Okay, so this is actually one reason, one among many reasons, why the cultivation of bodhicitta is so important. Because bodhicitta, you know, wants to attain awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. So because of the wide scope of bodhicitta for the benefit of all sentient beings, because of the noble aspiration to have the highest attainment, actions done with that bodhicitta mind become very, very powerful. So purification practices that we do motivated by bodhicitta can purify a lot of previously created negative karma. Okay? That's one of the reasons why bodhicitta is so important. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Could you give an example how you would phrase it in your heart that I want to purify, say, my anger for the benefit of all sex and people? What do I touch inside?
Okay. So how? This is a very good question, practical question, you know. How do I phrase it in my heart that I want to purify my anger and all of the negative karma I've created out of this anger? I think the way you just said it was spot on, because it was very clear that you meant what you said. It doesn't require a lot of words, but you had feeling when you said it. And so it's the strength of that intention, you know, the strength of our regret for having created the karma, the strength of our determination not to do it again, okay? The strength of our refuge in bodhicitta, the concentration with which, you know, we do the purification practice. So you have that. That's it.
Would spending all our time with animals and admiring them more than humans cause us to be drawn to be born in them?
So, spending a lot of time with animals and admiring them more than humans be a cause to draw us towards an animal rebirth? Yes. Yeah? Because if we admire a certain kind of body, you know, then it, our mind's going to be drawn towards that. Of course, that's not going to be the only cause for it. We have to have created various karma before us. But that mind of, you know, oh, what a beautiful cat or dog or goldfish or whatever it is, you know, and you're really admiring it, then the mind is drawn towards that. And that facilitates the ripening of the karma. That doesn't mean that we avoid animals. If we look at animals with compassion, yeah, and we want to help them, that clearly is something very virtuous. That's not going to cause rebirth as an animal. But when you sit there and go, oh, to be a kitty, all you do is sleep all day, you don't have to worry about all these things that I always worry about, it must be a really nice life. If you have that kind of, you know, attitude, then that draws your mind towards that, helps that kind of karma ripen. If you have an attitude of, oh, that kitty, you know, is kind of trapped in that body due to karma, and they're such a, you know, a sweet being, but wouldn't it be wonderful if they were free of lower rebirths? So I'm going to chant some mantra and do my recitations out loud and invite them to the teachings, then, you know, that acts, you know, that creates virtue, that kind of thought and action.
The bodies of us are able to go into different times and be a benefit there, and can they take the form of another ghost?
Yeah.
Or do they?
I imagine them like a human being.
Okay. So bodhisattvas, you know, who have compassion for beings in these realms, they can take, you know, bodies that look like the beings in those realms in order to benefit them.
Mm-hmm. Could our anger created by ourselves or caused by our ego bring us to a lower realm?
What do you think?
Even if this anger did not make me kill or steal or take drastic actions.
Okay, even if the anger didn't make you kill or steal or take drastic action. When we talk about the 10 non-virtues, 3 of them are mental, aren't they? Yeah, what's the mental non-virtue that would create heavy destructive karma? Yeah, ill will and malice would be the extension of that kind of anger. Let's go on to the meditation on refuge now. Okay, so let's close your eyes, come back to your visualization of the Buddha on the crown of your head. So from the Guru Buddha's body on the crown of your head, there is emitted an assembly consisting of spiritual mentors, deities, the three jewels, heroes and heroines, Dharma protectors and guardians that fill all of space. So from the Buddha on your head, radiate out all these other holy beings. So clearly, visualize clearly the objects of refuge surrounding the Guru Buddha on your head. Even if you can't see everyone individually, just have the sense of there being a huge assembly of realized beings around you. Keeping in mind the good qualities of their body, speech, and mind, and their activities, then think, from now on, please protect me and all sentient beings from the fears and dangers of cyclic existence as a whole, and especially from the fears and dangers of rebirth in the lower realms. So make that intense requests to them. And then with intense aspiration, think, I take refuge in the spiritual mentors. I take refuge in the meditational deities. And I take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And request them for their guidance to show you the way so that you will be free from unfortunate rebirths and be able to actualize your spiritual potential and your spiritual aspirations. A stream of nectar flows from the three jewels, dissolving into you and into the other sentient beings. It purifies all of your destructive karma, negativities, and obscurations. The inspiration of the three jewels enters your mind and enhances your lifespan, merit, and qualities of scriptural knowledge and realization. Thus take refuge 100,000, 10,000, 100,000 times. And with the awareness of the temporary and ultimate benefits of taking refuge in the three jewels, thoroughly train in the refuge precepts. And so I have a strong determination, this is what I'm going to do. So when we take refuge, it's helpful to cultivate three causes that will make our refuge very sincere and very deep. So the first cause is this awareness of the possibility of being born in unfortunate realms, or just the awareness of, you know, the possibility of being born in samsara in general. and not just the possibility of samsara in general, but if our minds are, you know, clouded by ignorance and afflictions, then definitely we'll be reborn in samsara in general. You know, so motivated by that wish to avoid that kind of rebirth, that's one reason to take refuge. And then the second reason is to have, by having faith and confidence in the ability of the three jewels to guide us from that situation by showing us, teaching us what to practice and what to abandon. And then the third cause is for Mahayana refuge is compassion for other living beings, thinking that I am turning for refuge to the three jewels, not just for myself, but for the benefit of all living beings, with my ultimate aim being to attain Buddhahood for their benefit. So if we spend some time generating those causes, doing those meditations, then it makes our refuge very strong when we take refuge. Then it's not just, oh, I take refuge, it's, I take refuge. I really mean this. So, in terms of the second cause, you know, having faith and conviction and trust in the three jewels and their ability to guide us, then to cultivate that, we have to know the qualities of the three jewels. So, that's what I'm going to talk about now. Actually, before I talk about the qualities of the three jewels, I want to talk about this very beautiful proof that the three jewels exist. Okay? And this comes from Nagarjuna, from his treatise on the Middle Way. And what I'll do is I'll read to you a passage from a new book which hasn't come out yet, but will come out soon. Here's the cover. Front cover and back cover. So its title is Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions. And in it, there's a chapter on refuge, talking about taking refuge according to the Pali tradition, as practiced in South Asia and Southeast Asia, and according to the Sanskrit tradition, as practiced in East Asia and the Himalaya regions. Okay, so the chapter on refuge. Let me read this part, I guess. Okay. So in both the Pali and Sanskrit sutras, the Buddha said that whoever sees the interdependent nature of phenomena sees the Dharma. Whoever sees dependent arising sees the Dharma. And whoever sees the Dharma sees the Tathagata. Okay, so seeing the Tathagata, seeing the Buddha, is not with our eyes. It's through seeing the Dharma, and seeing the Dharma is not through seeing the text. It's through understanding the interdependent nature of things. So Nagarjuna explained that the key to proving the existence of the three jewels is understanding the interdependent nature of phenomena. Okay. So, upon examination, we find that persons and phenomena are dependent. There's three aspects of dependence. Yeah. One is conditioned things depend on causes and conditions. A sprout arises from a seed. Our experiences arise dependent on our actions. Okay, so causal dependence. Second, all phenomena, both impermanent and permanent ones, depend on their constituent parts. Everything has parts. Nothing is some kind of solid whole. Our body is made of parts, arms, legs, and so forth. And these are made of other parts, and our mind also is made of parts, different aspects, different kinds of minds, different mental factors, different moments of mind. Okay. And then on the subtlest level, all phenomena depend on the mind that conceives and designates them. Okay. So all phenomena exist in relationship to the mind, not as objective things out there. Okay? So, for example, on the basis of our body and mind, then, you know, the person is designated, whoever you are. Yeah? In dependence on the collection of parts of the body arranged in a certain way, we designate body. Okay? So, that's talking about dependent arising. Now, ignorance, the source of samsara, grasps all persons and phenomena as having a self, okay, an independent, inherent essence that is unrelated to anything else, such as causes and conditions, parts, and the mind that conceives and designates them. So whereas things are dependent in these three ways, ignorance apprehends them or grasps them as existing in the exact opposite way, as totally independent of other factors. Okay. Thus, ignorance is an erroneous mind since it lacks a valid basis. It misapprehends things. Wisdom, on the other hand, is a reliable mind since it apprehends reality. It realizes that all persons and phenomena are empty of inherent existence because they exist dependent on other factors. So things are empty of independent existence because they exist dependent on causes and conditions, parts, the mind that conceives and designates them. Wisdom's apprehension of reality can overpower ignorance because it apprehends reality, and it's the opposite of ignorance. And with repeated meditation, wisdom can completely eradicate ignorance from our mind stream, making liberation possible. You got it so far? Okay, so what happened there? We started with dependent arising, showed how dependent arising, you know, indicated emptiness, how the wisdom of realizing emptiness can overpower ignorance, and thus how liberation can be attained. So in this way, knowledge of dependent arising helps us to understand the Four Noble Truths. Okay? The Four Noble Truths that form the basic framework of the Buddha's teachings. Ignorance misapprehending reality gives rise to afflictions which create karma, which lead to dukkha, or unsatisfactory conditions. That's all dependent arising. You know, how the first noble truth depends on the second noble truth. Okay. So this is the truth of dukkha and the truth of its origin, the first two truths of the Aryas. Yeah, Aryas being noble beings, being superior beings who have perceived the nature of reality directly. Knowledge of dependent arising also enables us to understand emptiness and selflessness. Persons and other phenomena are empty of independent existence because they are dependent. emptiness and dependent arising are established by reasoning, and they can also be directly experienced. The wisdom understanding emptiness is the fourth noble truth, true paths. And they counteract ignorance, wrong views, and afflictions that are founded on the misapprehension of reality. So in this way, we can actualize a state in which all ignorance and afflictions have been removed. That is nirvana, true cessation, the third noble truth. Are you seeing what's happening? That based on dependent arising, we can prove that the first two noble truths exist. Based on dependent arising, we do that through following the causal chain of ignorance leading to afflictions, to karma, to dukkha. Based on dependent arising, we can also prove the last two noble truths. Because dependent arising means that things are empty of independent existence. The wisdom knowing that is the fourth noble truth. That has the power to eradicate all the afflictions and leads us to actualize the third noble truth. So what we've just done is prove the existence of the four noble truths. This is so incredible. This proof of Nagarjuna is just so, it totally is mind-blowing. Yeah. So thus, the four noble truths of the Aryas exist. Yeah. The last two of the four truths, true cessations and true paths, are the Dharma jewel. When we take refuge in the Dharma, what's the Dharma jewel of the three jewels? True cessations and true paths that we actualize in our own consciousness, because that is what is going to really protect us from dukkha. Persons who have actualized at least some of these paths and cessations in their continuum are the Sangha jewel. When they progress to the point where all afflictions and obscurations have been eliminated and all paths and qualities brought to perfection, they become the Buddha jewel. What have we just done? We just proved that the three jewels exist. Okay. Thus, beginning with the fact that all phenomena are empty of independent existence, yet rise dependent on other factors, we can prove the existence of the three jewels. For this reason, the Buddha said that those who see interdependence see the Dharma, and those who see the Dharma see the Tathagata. Does that completely floor you? It floors me. I remember the first time I heard it, you know, His Holiness explaining it, and I was gone. Oh my goodness, yeah. Because I remember, you know, years ago, saying, when I was a beginner, saying, how do I know the Buddha exists? How do I know? Yeah, because my teachers say so, because some scripture says so. How do I know that the Buddha exists? How do I know enlightenment's possible? Yeah. This explains it, yeah. So you may not totally understand it now, but some seeds have been planted. And if you come back to it later and really think about dependent arising and emptiness, it's really quite amazing, yeah, how this works. Yeah. And so through this, we can also see that not only if we prove the existence of the external Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, yeah, but we've also proven the possibility of us becoming the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Because by eliminating, by generating wisdom, we can overpower the ignorance, eliminate the afflictions and polluted karma, stop the dukkha. Okay. Through dependent arising, we can cultivate all the virtues on the path, all the good qualities on the path. Okay, so we can become the three jewels ourselves. So historically, the evolution of the three jewels is different. First there was the Buddha, then there was the Dharma teachings, then there was the Sangha who actualized them. Yeah, that's the external refuge, you know, what we call the outer refuge. But in terms of the internal refuge, yeah, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha that we're that we can become, first there's going to be the Dharma jewel, the true cessations and true paths. Then we will become the Sangha jewel, those who have realized emptiness directly, upon total purification of the mind and development of our good qualities, we become the Buddha jewel. Okay. So that's the inner refuge that we ourselves can become. That is the true refuge. But we have to start by taking refuge in the external refuge. Yeah, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that are already there. Okay? Yeah?
What guarantees that the true cessation and paths are always there? Because isn't there supposed to be a time where the Dharma can be non-existent and then, I don't know.
Okay. So how do we know that the true paths and true cessations are always there? Isn't there a time when the Dharma is non-existent?
Right.
When we talk about our universe, our planet Earth, yes, there was a time on planet Earth before Shakyamuni Buddha manifested, before he appeared, where we didn't have the Dharma teachings. But as I was saying, our planet Earth is this tiny speck of dust. Yeah. There's the whole rest of the universe. Yeah. So there's Buddhas, there's Dharma, there's Sangha. Yeah, in the Pure Lands, in the rest of the universe, yeah, in the nature of reality, they're all there. Don't think of just, you know, what exists and appears on our planet. Because when you think of the Buddha's omniscient mind, do you need planet Earth for the Buddha's omniscient mind to exist? No. Yeah? So all these things exist. And we have to broaden our mind, because right now we tend to just say, well, you know, I only believe it if I can see it. But that presents some problems, because then we don't believe that the inside of our body exists because we can't see it. Or then we couldn't believe that atoms exist because we can't see atoms either. Okay? So there's many things beyond our narrow focus. I go on? Okay, so if we're going to talk about the qualities of the Tathagata, both Pali tradition and the Sanskrit tradition talk about what's called the four kinds of fearlessness. This is her name, Jigme. Okay? Or it's also kind of called the four kinds of self-confidence. So there's four things that the Buddha is fully confident and fearless in stating. Yeah. And so, like I said, these are mentioned in both the Pali and the Sanskrit tradition. So first, the Buddha sees no ground on which any recluse, yeah, so any kind of spiritual practitioner, Brahman, God, or anyone else could accuse him of, one, claiming to be fully awakened, although he is not fully awakened to certain things. So nobody can accuse the Buddha of making the false claim that he's fully awakened, even though he doesn't know a lot of stuff. Okay. Second, nobody can accuse the Buddha of claiming to have destroyed all the pollutants that he has not destroyed. Okay? So, of making a false claim that he has freed himself of certain mental afflictions and defilements that in fact he hasn't freed himself of. Nobody can accuse the Buddha of making that kind of false claim. Why? Because he's eliminated all the defilements. Yeah. Regarding the first one, why can't they claim that? Because he is awakened to all things. Okay. Third, nobody can accuse him of calling things obstructions that are not obstructions. Okay. In other words, people cannot accuse the Buddha when he says ignorance, anger, and attachment are obstructions to nirvana or are the causes of misery. Nobody can accuse him of being erroneous and making a mistake in what he said are, you know, the defilements. And fourth, nobody can accuse him of teaching a dharma that does not lead someone who practices it to complete destruction of dukkha. So nobody can accuse the Buddha of teaching a path that if you practice it, won't lead you to nirvana. Why can't they accuse him of that? Because the path he teaches does lead to nirvana. So the Buddha was completely fearless in making these statements. Yeah? Because nobody could criticize him because what he said was true. Whereas other teachers, you know, they say this, they say that, then people can say, hey, wait a minute, that doesn't work. That doesn't hold up to reasoning. Or I know somebody who had the total opposite experience or whatever. Okay? So these four fearlessnesses they enable the Buddha to teach the Dharma with perfect self-confidence, free from all self-doubt, because he's awakened regarding all aspects of objects of knowledge, because he's destroyed all pollutants, because he correctly identifies obstructions on the path, and because he gives teachings that lead those who practice them to nirvana. Okay? So this shows that the Buddha is a reliable guide. Huh? So when we contemplate these four fearlessnesses, it gives us confidence in the Buddha's ability to guide us. Okay, that he knows what he's talking about. Okay, then there's also a list of 10 powers that appear in both the Pali and Sanskrit traditions. And these 10 powers are a set of exceptional knowledge that exceptional knowledges that are exclusive to the Buddha. Okay, so they enable the Buddha to do a Buddha's unique activities, you know, establish his doctrine in the world, skillfully teach sentient beings, and lead them to awakening. Okay, so 10 special powers or qualities of the Buddha. So, You know, when we first hear these four fearlessnesses, the ten qualities, they sound kind of, you know, up there. But, you know, when you think about it, and I think one reason they seem kind of up there and impossible is because we're so stuck in our view of ourself that we can't imagine anybody knowing more than we do. Or anybody knowing things that aren't within the range of what we can know with our senses. Okay? So it gets some use to thinking that, you know, it's possible to know the kinds of things that a Buddha knows, and that that is what gives the Buddha the ability to be such a skillful and wise teacher. Okay, so let's go through these ten. First, with direct, unmistaken perception, the Tathagata knows the tenable and the untenable. So that means the relations between actions and their results, as well as the implications of actions done by Aryas and ordinary beings. So Buddhas understand everything about karma and the results of karma. So not just the general principles, but also the individual actions a specific person has done that bring specific results in one rebirth or another. I mean, so this kind of knowledge is just, you know, unbelievable to know all these kinds of things. But that's because the Buddha's mind is completely clear of defilements, and the mind has the ability to perceive things when it's clear. Okay. Two, only the Tathagata fully and accurately knows the intricacies of past, present, and future karma and their results, including subtle causes leading to a particular experience in the beginningless lives of each sentient being. So that's what I was just talking about, that a Buddha is the only one who knows that. Three, the Tathagata knows the various destinations of ordinary beings. So the different samsaric realms and the paths leading somebody to be reborn in any of the different realms of samsara. Yeah. And the Tathagata also knows the destinations of the Aryas, of the three vehicles. You know, so we have the hearer vehicle, solitary realizer vehicle, bodhisattva vehicle. And, you know, so the destinations of those vehicles are nirvana. And the Buddha also knows all the paths to get to those results. So again, you know, Buddha knows the results, he knows the paths. If we learn from him, we're getting correct knowledge. And then we need to practice it. Four, the Buddha fully understands the world and all the various elements that compose it. Okay? So all the physical elements, all the mental elements. I won't go into all the details of what they are. And he knows them with wisdom, seeing them as impermanent, conditioned, and dependent processes. Okay. Five, and this is a particular one that I think is what makes a Buddha a very good teacher, is he knows the different inclinations of beings. So there's spiritual aims and the spiritual vehicles, the paths that they're attracted to. So this enables him to teach the Dharma according to individuals' faculties, abilities, and aspirations. So the Buddha can tune in to different people and know what kind of teaching they need to hear according to their individual inclinations and aspirations and so on, way of thinking. Six, the Buddha knows the strength of each being's faculties of faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And again, teaches them accordingly. So Buddha can tune in to where people are on the path. Yeah. about what are their strong points, what are their weak points, and then teach them accordingly. 7, because the Tathagata has mastered the jhanas, the form realm, states of meditation, also the 8 meditative liberations, the 9 meditative absorptions, and he knows the defilements, cleansing, and emergence regarding them. Yeah. So the defilements are impediments, that obstruct us on the path. And also they obstruct us from entering meditative absorption or having entered meditative absorption. The defilements make it deteriorate. So the Buddha is able to identify what these defilements are. He also knows how to cleanse them, so the method for eliminating these impediments to concentration. And he also knows their emergence, which is the way to come out of a state of meditative absorption. Okay, so how to go in meditative absorption, how to cleanse the impediments, how to come out of it. Yeah. So he's therefore qualified to be able to instruct others on how to cultivate these meditative states. Yeah, without becoming attached to the bliss of those concentrations. Then 8, the Tathagata recollects in detail his manifold past lives with their aspects and particulars. Okay, so he knows all of his previous lives, who he was, what he did, all of his previous relationships with sentient beings, and, the types of relationships, who he had strong relationships with, and so on. And so this also gives the Buddha the awareness of who would be most beneficial for him to teach now according to these previous connections with different beings. And then 9, with the divine eye, he sees beings dying and being reborn according to their karma. So knowing this, he does what is most beneficial to guide each being to awakening. And he has the ability to manifest in different ways without necessarily identifying himself, saying, "Hi, I'm a Buddha. I'm here to help you," because that wouldn't work. So, the Buddha appears as undercover agents, not identifying themselves, but with the aim to benefit us and the skill and the wisdom to do that. And then 10, realizing with direct knowledge, the Tathagata here and now enters upon and abides in the unpolluted liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom, and knows that all defilements have been eradicated. Okay, he also knows the level of realization and attainment of each living being, and so how to teach them accordingly. Yeah. So, when you think of this kind of knowledge that a Buddha has, then we can see why the Buddha would be a good guide on the path, and why it's possible to trust the Buddha's teachings. So this is kind of, it's kind of like reading the CV of somebody, isn't it? You haven't met them yet, so you read the CV, and except this is, this one isn't an exaggerated CV, it's something that the Tathagata really does have these qualities. Then after you meet a person, you might read the CV and, that person really liked that, this looks a little inflated. Then you meet the person and you get to know whether it's really like that. So similarly, we read these kind of descriptions of the quality of a Buddha, and then we begin to practice and we listen to teachings. And we see, if what the Buddha says holds water, and if it works. So I'll open it to other questions in a minute, but there was one question somebody sent in. So somebody said, I keep thinking about and analyzing one pair of the eight worldly concerns, praise and blame. Anybody else have problems with praise and blame? And I'm experiencing some confusion and trouble in being able to effectively contemplate the causes of sentient beings' attachment to praise and blame. If there are other causes aside from self-grasping ignorance. Okay, self-grasping ignorance is the A number one cause. Yeah? What's the henchman that aids self-grasping ignorance?
Self-centered
thought. Me, 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 me. I want, I need, I have to have, I'm the most important. Okay? Okay. So, I want to understand, you know, the practice and meditation leading to the cessation of attachment to praise and blame. Okay, so what do we need to do to cease the attachment to praise and blame? Yeah, there's two kinds of antidotes to attachment to praise, aversion to blame. Okay, one is a temporary antidote that is easier, that applies specifically to, you know, attachment to praise, aversion to blame. The other is a general and also more profound antidote, which is realizing emptiness, because that's what destroys the self-grasping ignorance, which destroys the attachment and anger, and so then you don't have these eight worldly concerns. Yeah, so realizing emptiness is the ultimate antidote. But since that is a little bit difficult to do, and it's going to take us a while to do it, then we cultivate the temporary antidotes that can help us more immediately in our life. Okay? So when we're attached to praise, what do we do? What do you do? What do you think about? What do you practice when you're attached to praise? Let's hear it from you, practitioners. What do you do?
Think about death.
Okay, think about death.
And
yep.
What is praise going to mean at the time? You know, what does it do for my growth as a practitioner?
What does praise do for my growth as a practitioner? I want to, you know, have a good future rebirth, attain liberation, attain full awakening. How does praise help me actualize that?
And what
zero. It doesn't do anything.
And what also, is praise anyway?
Yeah. Then also, what is praise anyway? It's just people's blah blah. Just sound waves. Blah 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 blah. People blah blah all the time. Blah blah blah. Do you take refuge in people's blah blah? Is that a reliable source of refuge? Somebody praises you, oh, I take refuge in the praise you gave me. Blah, 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 blah. Especially after we've had these discussions of how people lie and manipulate and flatter in order to get something from somebody else. Are you going to take refuge in other people's praise? Does because somebody said something make it true? What else are you going to practice?
Anything we know we've been taught by someone else, so it's not reflecting on us.
Yeah, so everything we know was taught to us by somebody else. No sense in getting attached to praise and thinking we're great.
What someone praises, someone else might criticize.
Yeah, what somebody praises, somebody else might criticize. Not might, will. Yeah. So praise is very unreliable. This person says, oh, you're so good for this quality. The next person says, criticizes you for the same quality. So what is reliable about praise?
Imagining getting it, and getting it, and getting it, and getting it, and being satisfied or not.
Yeah. So imagining, I love this part, of having all the praise you ever wanted from all the people you ever wanted praise and approval from. This is a great meditation. You just sit there and you daydream. All the people who you've ever wanted to praise you, all the nice things they ever could have said to you, you imagine all of that coming. And then you say, then, am I happy? Am I satisfied? Do I feel good about myself? Is that the answer to my not feeling good about myself? I've imagined getting every single praise I ever could have had. And is that going to solve my problem of not feeling good about myself? No. What's going to solve my problem of not feeling good about myself?
Transforming mind.
Clearly, but how? Into what?
Buddha.
Yes. Thank you. Very astute.
I'll take care of it for sure.
So, you know, what, on a temporary way, what is going to help us feel good about ourselves?
Cultivating our good qualities in general.
Yeah.
And cultivating our confidence and our capacity.
Yeah, cultivating our good qualities in general, cultivating an awareness of our Buddha nature, having a kind heart. Mm-hmm. Yeah? If you have a kind heart, you're going to feel good about yourself. Yeah? If you have a kind heart, you know, that wishes others well, that forgives others for their foibles and what they've done for you, you're going to be at peace with yourself. Don't you think? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay. How about aversion to blame? What do you practice when you don't like criticism and blame? Wrong answer, said Meg. She said people pleasing.
To avoid blame.
Yeah, to avoid blame. She'd become a people pleaser. Yeah, I don't like blame, so what do? I please everybody. I run around doing this for this person and this for that person, trying to be what I think they think I should be, and then they'll all like me.
I'm still criticizing.
Yeah. Does that work?
No.
No. We've tried that already. Yeah. It doesn't work. They still criticize us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So what do you practice when you get criticized?
The wheel of sharp weapons returning full
circle. This is the wheel of sharp weapons returning full cycle upon me for having dumped my anger and criticism and blame on other people.
Seeing their own happiness. Mm-hmm. People who criticize you usually aren't very happy. You see their suffering is why they're
So instead of focus on what we feel due to their criticism, I think something happened. It doesn't seem to be amplifying. Oh, there. See that people who criticize are miserable. And so instead of focusing on our misery, having compassion for their suffering.
You could actually look at the criticism and see if there's any truth in it.
Oh, imagine that. We could look at the criticism and see if there's some truth to it. And if there is, we say thank you very much because you're helping me along the path. And if there's no truth in it, we say,
thank you very much. You're helping me to practice patience.
Yeah, thank you very much. You're helping me to practice patience. Okay? If you don't like blame, read Working with Anger. Read chapter 6 of Shantideva. Okay. Okay, we've gone quite a bit over time. I don't think I'm going to be able to take any questions now. But maybe people have enough to think about. Yeah? So spend some time thinking about these things. You know, rebirth in the lower realms, refuge, you know, this question about the 8 worldly concerns. And the Singapore group did request that we continue with the teachings, yeah, as did Cheryl. And so we will continue with the teachings next week and so on. Okay. None of the people here requested, so I don't know, maybe... Maybe you're not going to come, or maybe you can't come, or...
Please continue.
I don't know. Yeah? I mean, you just kind of take it for granted. There's no need to say anything.
I think we didn't know we were eligible to ask.
You're not eligible to ask?
Because this was requested by somebody else.
It was requested by somebody else, but that means you can't ask for teachings?
But I recall distinctly when you asked the question, there was a silent yes and a smile.
Yeah, a silent yes.
I'm sure.
A silent yes communicates a lot.
Smiles do.
We'll make a banner next time.
Yeah.
We'll make the request louder.
Okay.
Request next time.
You know, when you used to pester your mother when you were a little kid, did you do it silently? You know, no, you asked loudly, repeatedly. Okay. You didn't. You said, I want cookies! I want cookies!
Okay, ready, everybody?
I want cookies! Please!
Okay. I mean, it's one of the seven limbs, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, it's one of the seven limbs. Why is it one of the seven limbs? Because it's important to do. Because we have to create the causes. Okay. Okay, let's dedicate.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhasa's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Ashravasti Abbey in the West. Glory.